Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And I've had some really cool guests on this program and some amazing folk people, folk singers, everyone from folks like Tom Paxton to Chris Smither. Just recently spoke to Oscar Brand, who's been there pretty much from the beginning of the modern folk movement. And now I've got someone who is also, in a curatorial way, as well as her own singer-songwriter way, someone who's been really important to the folk scene of the past, I would say, 30 years now. So it is an honor and a pleasure to have in the studio at WGBB, Christine Lavin. Hey, Christine.
Hey, Dave. Nice to meet you.
So you are, like, a busy, busy, busy kind of a person.
Yeah, I've been touring now for close to 22 years full time. I moved to New York back in 1976 to take guitar lessons with Dave Van Ronk, and my first 8 years in New York, I took lessons from him at night, and I would perform on the weekends, and I would work day jobs as a temp all over Manhattan. For 8 years, I did that before I finally got the nerve to quit my day job. And
well, you know, we even have to go backwards now because I want to know, what was it like? He must have been terribly frightening.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you one thing. When you took guitar lessons from Dave Van Ronk, you practiced. Because what nerve would it take to go to a guitar lesson and not be prepared and sit and make a fool of yourself in front of him? He was quite an imposing figure. He's about 6'4". Huge guy, huge hands, but very delicate hands. And he was a terrific guitar teacher for someone like me because he was left-handed and played right-handed guitar like me. And he also couldn't read music like me. But he made up his own system of letters and dashes. It's crazy kind of tablature. And I actually worked for him for a couple of years in exchange for lessons. I was his transcriptionist of his tablature.
Oh, so you know how to write music, in fact.
He invented it himself. It was done on a typewriter. Like, if there was a capital E, that would mean a capital E with an underline underneath it was the low E string there. And if it was a small E with a line on top of it, it was that E, the high E. And so at one time I had, this is after he had died, and I was going to be part of the Joni Mitchell wall-to-wall at Symphony Space, and I decided I really went out on a limb, Dave. I was crazy. I did Dave Van Ronk's arrangement of Joni Mitchell's song, what's the one, Urge for Going.
That oh, wow.
But I hadn't done it in like 15 years, so his widow faxed to my hotel room the chart so I could relearn it. And I kept waiting and waiting for the front desk to call me to tell me this music chart had come, and they didn't call. So I called down and I said, I've been waiting for an hour now for a fax, a music chart. They said, well, something came for you, but it's not music. It looks like a math problem. So that's what it looked like to the layperson.
But it's funny, when even that little bit that you played, that sounded very Joni-esque.
Well, the funny thing about, let me see if I can play it. I see, I'm totally not prepared. Wait. Whoops. Something like that.
Yeah.
But when Dave played his version for Joni Mitchell, the first words out of her mouth were, what tuning is that in? And it was in standard tuning. But she uses such oddball tuning, she didn't even recognize standard tuning when it was in front of her.
Have you ever met her, by the way?
Yeah, actually, Dave introduced me to her in Philadelphia probably around 1980. He was part of a big show down there, and so he took me along to meet her. And in fact, when I met her, I didn't say a word. He said, Joni, this is Christine Lavin, one of my students. And she said hello, and I went,
yeah.
But I figured it was better to say nothing than to say something stupid.
Oh. Well, eventually, did you loosen up, or by then she had walked away?
It was this huge thing. Tom Waits was there.
Oh, my God. Did you talk to Tom Waits?
Yeah, I did.
And?
Let's see.
We'll recreate the moment. I'll be Tom.
I said, hi, Tom. I met you at such and such. And he goes, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. Like, there you go.
I was living in a car at that point.
But I'll tell you my Bob Dylan story, which is really funny.
Tell.
I was, in 1975, I was a waitress at the Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, and Lena was invited by Bob to be part of the entourage for the tour he was doing called the Rolling Thunder Review. And so, I'll never forget it, it was on Halloween night that we left Saratoga Springs, that's where Lena lived, at the Cafe Lena. It was me, Lena Spencer, and Joni Miller. Lena had the invitation, Joni had the car, and I had a driver's license, as did Joni. So we started driving about 11 o'clock at night, and every hour or so, the car would just sort of glide to a halt on the Massachusetts Turnpike. But Joni, she was used to, so she would pull the car over to the side of the road. She would open up the hood. I would strike a match and hold the match inside the engine so she could see the two wires that needed to be put together.
Oh, that's right. That's, yeah.
And I kept, I'm on the turnpike holding a lit match inside a car engine. I kept thinking, this can't be a good idea.
No, not.
But the car never blew up. So we got there at like 6 o'clock in the morning, and we traveled with the Rolling Thunder Review for about 5 days. And we got to see the show from all different angles, from the wings, from out front, from the front row. And the day that we were going back to Saratoga, because Lena had shows that weekend, the whole entourage had pulled into this rest stop someplace on the Massachusetts Turnpike. And Dylan and the gang were going up to Jack Kerouac's grave to film something. So we're sitting at this little table in this rest stop with a map, trying to figure out what road do we take to get back to Saratoga Springs. So Bob Dylan comes and sits down with us. He goes, hey, what you doing? And so I said, oh, well, we have to go back to Saratoga Springs. We're looking at the map. He goes, oh. And then he didn't say anything. We didn't say anything. And I could see he's a nervous type. So I figured he's going to get up. So I wanted to say something.
Of course.
Bob, I love the show, because at this point I'd seen it maybe 4 times. So I love it. And I love how you end with, this land is your land. It's such a, you know, great thing. But have you ever heard that verse written by Arlo Guthrie's friend, the Indian? He goes, no, how's it go? So he goes, this land is your land. This land was my land until I sold you Manhattan Island. You moved our nation to the reservation. This land was stole by you from me. And Bob Dylan goes, oh, that's good. And he gets up and he leaves. And I thought, my one chance to talk to Bob Dylan, I tell him how his song goes.
Well.
That was it.
You know, better than Tony Mitchell and not saying anything.
Yeah, I guess. I still haven't seen, I was working both nights at the PBS special on the
Martin
Scorsese.
It was.
I heard Dave was in it and that he also came across very well.
He was, yeah, because he's this outsized personality. It was really, it's a good documentary. And they didn't censor it, which I was very proud of Channel 13 for, because there were a couple of F-bombs in there, and I was very proud, yes.
Yeah.
He didn't say any, but some other people used them.
You know, by the way, an album I made way back in 1981, I think, called Future Fossils, there's a song on it called The Ramblin' Waltz, and that was my experience with the Rolling Thunder Review. I wrote that song about Ramblin' Jack.
Yeah.
It was so
nice Jewish boy and Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Yeah. Elliott Adnopos. But it was interesting to watch him, you know, I mean, it was such a great opportunity for him, and Dylan really owed him such a debt because of all the stylistic things he learned from Jack. And to see the crowd go crazy for Jack Elliott, and then he'd walk off into the wings and there'd be nobody, and he'd just be sort of standing around and looking around, and I thought, wow. And then to see them afterwards in the hotel, after getting all this adulation and love from thousands of people, and then they're back on the road alone, and it was a real interesting experience, because I, at that point, was just a waitress and a bread baker at the Cafe Lena, and I didn't have any, I had no confidence to think that I could have a career in music, so.
Well, at what point did you? In other words, at what point did you get to the point in the mid-70s where you were a baker and playing and as best you could? Within a couple of years, you had a label and music became the career.
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 12, watching lessons on public television, and playing guitar and writing songs was something I always did, but I come from a very conservative Catholic family that I was going to be a nurse. That was my major in college. But at the Cafe Lena, every once in a while would put me up on stage in between during the breaks of the headliner, and I got such a positive response from the audience. I figured, well, there's something I'm doing that people like, and I couldn't figure out exactly why, because at the cafe I saw so many really first-rate storytellers, guitarists, performers, singers, and I thought, well, I don't play guitar that well, I don't sing that well, I don't write that well, but doggone it, people like me.
Right.
Like Stuart Smalley, I'm good enough. Gosh darn it, people like me. And so the turning point was one night, it was in February 1976, Don McLean's manager was in the house when I did a co-bill with this guy named Michael Devin, who was a piano player, and he gave me his card, and he said, you should come to New York, but you got to learn how to play guitar better, and once you do, look me up. So that very same night, Dave Van Ronk was driving through Saratoga Springs on his way from Montreal, and he stopped off, and Lena said, hey, Christine, play a song for Dave. So I played him, The Ramblin' Waltz, and Dave said, you should come to New York. And I said, oh, I will, but I have to learn how to play guitar better. He goes, I'm a teacher. I'll teach you. And I was like, okay, I don't believe in coincidence. There we go.
That was a day that the planets literally aligned.
2 weeks later, I was living on 3rd Street between A and B, one block over from the Hells Angels. I was living on the apartment was so funky that I didn't have a bed. It was two wooden horses with a door on top of it with a piece of foam rubber on top of that.
Now that apartment sells for about $8,000 a month. Yeah.
Well, unbelievably, David Massengill still lives in that same building. And I'm sure, yeah, it's much fancier now than it was.
But, gosh, and so that was... Now, I can probably play the Ramblin' Waltz from Future Fossils unless you want to do that one live. Or?
Oh, gosh.
No, that's that one.
In like 20 years. Hi, this is Christine Lavin, and you're listening to WGBB AM 1240. Dave's Gone By. That's a very interesting thing, too. I've been doing this so long now that a lot of my older songs, I don't remember how they go. But I keep writing new ones. That's
well,
why
yeah.
I have finite space in my brain.
Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, as someone who has also who's written plays and songs and stuff like that, do you ever go through these periods? Because you're pretty prolific. I mean, you've put out about 17 albums in 20 years. That's pretty, that's a lot. And... do you ever get to this point where every melody has been written, every topic's been done, every song I could think of, somebody probably wrote like 20 years ago or
well,
not?
That's in my dark days, I think like that. But I think that as a songwriter, see, I write from inspiration. I can't sit down on command, and I don't have a writing time every day. And some people do that,
sure.
I admire the fact that they can do that. So it is sometimes it's scary. You think, is that the last song I've ever written? But they just keep coming. But I must say, because I can't read music, and some of my songs, especially the song Winter in Manhattan on my new record, I when I played it and I sang it, I thought, man, this is hard for me to play. This is really hard for me to sing. What am I doing to myself? I'm writing songs beyond my own ability. And that song in particular, I thought, man, I wish I could get a group like the Accidentals to sing the song. And then I thought, maybe they'll hear it and they'll want to do it. And then I thought, you know what? I should just call them up and I should hire them and pay them to write an arrangement and sing this on the record. And so that's what I did. And the irony of it is, when we recorded that song, their version of it, it was June 13th, 2005, which was, at that time, it was the hottest day of the year. It was so hot. And when you have eight people in a vocal booth, because this is an a cappella group, all the air conditioning had to be turned off.
Oh.
They were just sweating like dogs, and every 5 or 6 minutes we would open up the door of the vocal booth, and I was knitting a giant bath towel at the time, so I would wave that in the air to try to
and pass out water and stuff.
I brought lots of water for them,
but at least you gave them a song to sing about winter that kind of kept them cool mentally for a moment.
Well, the irony of it is, just about every winter or Christmas record is recorded in the summertime because you'd have to have that much lead time to have all the packaging done.
Sure.
And even, you know the song, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow?
Sure.
The first line is, oh, the weather outside is frightful. But that was written during a heat wave of 102 in Los Angeles. So when they said the weather outside is frightful, they meant it was so hot. But, of course, it's a winter song, Let It Snow.
Well, let's hear, not Let It Snow, but let us definitely hear the Accidentals doing Winter in Manhattan by Christine Lavin. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We are here with the wonderful and delightful and incredibly talented and prolific Christine Lavin, folk singer, who, well, also folk zinger. Why don't you explain the little play on words there?
That title actually came from a review of my show that I did in Orlando, Florida, maybe 10 years ago. And, of course, I cannot remember the name of the journalist. He gave the title folk singer, and I wrote to him, and I said, I love that title. Could I use that for an album cover, album title or something? And he said, of course, of course. And I said, I'll give you credit. No. When I bought a new computer last year, when I was switching over everything, I lost 7 years of email. It's just,
ooh.
I'm still hoping it's one day going to appear on my computer. I think it's gone. And his name is one of the things that got lost.
So you lost all those Chicken Soups for the Soul emails, didn't you? Little in-joke, if you know the album.
You know, the funny thing, there's a song called Chicken Soup for the Soul on the record, and it's about somebody gave me a free subscription to Chicken Soup for the Soul for the rest of my life. And the person who did that was not my downstairs neighbor, as I say in the song. It was folk singer David Roth.
No! A man would do that. Men don't read Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Well, David's very sensitive. He's a very, very nice guy.
Okay, no
but
problem.
But, of course, he doesn't know that. I don't think he's put two and two together, but he'll probably find out eventually now that I blabbed it. But the funny thing is, my brother, I stopped getting the Chicken Soup for the Soul, thank God. It took almost 2 years to get it off my computer. But my brother signed me up for the Writer's Almanac. And I started reading those every day. It was so interesting. Except one day, I just didn't want to read them anymore. But this, I'm afraid to unsubscribe because Garrison Keillor puts it together. Well, I'm afraid if I hook him on this bad list, Garrison Keillor will never have you on his show.
Oh, it's true. I mean, I've got, I have an email list for this show that, you know, I send people letting them know who's going to be on. And, you know, I'm curating that list. So if somebody says, please purge me from this email list, I'm like, you're never going to be a guest. They don't know it, but I'm like, I know who you are. You're doing cabaret right now, and you don't want to read my emails? I want to hear your music. So you're going to be on the permanent thing.
No, tell me. Who is it? Tell me.
No,
I'm not going to put you on the spot like that.
It's her name. She's a very funny and talented performer. Or at least she was. Now, of course, her career is completely going downhill because I'm trying to ruin it. But, you know... How about a folk song? How about a song from Folk Zinger by Christine Lavin, live in the studio by you, whatever you... Oh.
Of course, you know, it's my own record, but I have to look at it to... okay, you know what? I know what I'll play for you. The Peter Principle song.
Okay, a song about my penis. Here we go.
No. This song was co-written with Irvin Drake.
Actually, might as well explain a little bit about how famous and important Irvin Drake is.
Irvin Drake wrote Good Morning Heartache. He wrote, I Believe, the Frankie Lane song, I Believe for Every Drop of Rain That Falls. And he wrote my all-time favorite song, It Was a Very Good Year, the Frank Sinatra song. But dig this, folk fans. He wrote It Was a Very Good Year for the Kingston Trio. And it was the Kingston Trio recording that Frank Sinatra heard when he was driving from Los Angeles to Rancho Mirage. And he pulled over, called the radio station, said, who is that? That's wrong.
Who are those communist punks? Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing was Frank was working on his album, The September of My Years, which was his comeback record. And what more perfect song than It Was a Very Good Year for an album called The September of My Years. So... But since Frank, it was so emblazoned in his memory that that song was done by the Kingston Trio, that he always thought of it as a folk song, not knowing that Irvin Drake, the guy who wrote it, was not a folk writer. He wrote Good Morning Heartache. He wrote Tico Tico. And I recently, on Jonathan Schwartz's radio show, because he's such a Frank Sinatra aficionado, he's got a live recording of Frank doing, it was a very good year, and he goes, and now here's a little folk song for you kids.
Wow.
Frank, it wasn't a folk song.
Not when William Shatner did it.
But Irvin Drake, by the way, lives in Great Neck. Now, is this within your, you know, listening area?
Oh, totally. So, Irvin, if you're listening, well, listen to this.
He's a great guy. Okay, so this is a song that I co-wrote with Irvin. Boy, I haven't done this in months. I hope I can do it. Never have we felt our country more divided than Republicans came to New York to sway those few undecided. Three miles south of where they gather in this town, there's a deep, dark, empty hole in the ground. All of us who live here were shaken by that day, and the weeks and months that followed, some pain never goes away. The delegates all made the pilgrimage down to Ground Zero, posed for photographs with each reluctant hero. After 9/11, we had the sympathy of the world, though we cried, we felt pride every time our flag unfurled. But 3 years down the line, the sympathy is gone. He said, mission accomplished as the battle's raged on. How can mission be accomplished with the battle's raging on? We know exactly how many Americans have died in Iraq, but we never see the photos of the coffins coming back. We see photos of the torture done in our name. Lots of fingers pointing, no one taking blame. A filmmaker from Flint, Michigan makes a movie you won't see. Shines a spotlight on the dark side of our democracy. You'd rather close your eyes than engage us in debate. The platform of the uninformed breeds the politics of hate. New York City is everything so many of you fear. Chinese, Korean, Russian, even Arabic spoken here. Hasidic Jews and lesbians living right next door to single mothers raising kids while daddy's off to war. There are single fathers raising kids while mommy's off to war. Sent there by a leader who never had a clue, never had a single doubt about what he should do. He thinks God made him president. Heaven knows we didn't do it. Is it time for us to say, oh lordy, somebody blew it? Or are we witnessing the Peter Principle at work? The highest level of incompetence still expecting every perk? Or have we all gone crazy? Or could we be dead wrong? Can the righteous be defeated by the stupid and the strong? Someday will we be blacklisted because we wrote this song.
Christine Lavin on Dave's Gone By, a song called The Peter Principle. Not quite as funny as a lot of the songs you usually do, but an angry song. You don't do a lot of angry songs, but
no.
That one...
You know, the situation that we find ourselves in, people like me, folk singers like me who have never been overtly political, it's like we have no choice. You know, we're living in this world. I grew up at a military school in Peekskill, New York. My brother was actually appointed to go to West Point. He was a battalion commander at the military school. And then he flunked the physical because he has diplopia in his eyes. And then he became a conscientious objector. And then he ended up in Leavenworth Prison during the Vietnam War. And another one of my brothers went to Vietnam as a military policeman, and both guys, they're doing okay, but, you know, their lives changed. And my brother Tom saw horrible, horrible things, and my brother Greg, you know, he was only in Leavenworth for 5 months. He was sentenced to 6 months, but he was in for 5 months for good behavior. But it was absolutely frightening, and it's really scarred him for life. And I just, you know, to grow up at a military school where the military was, it was our life, it was my father's life. We didn't think of it as a bad thing, but watching, I mean, we're taping the day that there's another vigil, another Move On vigil, because 2,000 soldiers have died, 2,000 American soldiers have died in Iraq. But like the song, I said, you know, we know exactly how many Americans have died in Iraq, but we never see the photos of the coffins coming back. That is all kept, you know, according to the government, the administration, it's because of the privacy of the families. Other countries, they treat the war fallen with such dignity and with such respect and reverence, and this is all hidden away.
We all see, actually, the bodies either. I mean, that's what they're really not showing us, is what a dead American soldier looks like. Not to mention 26,000 dead, you know, Iraqi civilians, but I can't say that I feel the same for them as I do for dead Americans.
Originally, when I wrote this song, it was before the election, and it had a different ending. And it killed me. After the election, the original ending said, how did it go? Peter Principal at work, the highest level of incompetence, expecting every part. This is the original one. Enjoy it while you can. Your time is almost done. As the lucky streaks go, you've had quite a run. One term is all you get. Like father, like son.
Except, yeah.
And he won!
Yeah. That took the air out of, I really thought that took the air out of everybody's tires. I was pretty militant, and then that second election came, and he did win legitimately.
Well, there's still debate about that in Ohio. I just did a bunch of shows out there, and people are talking about how there was just a lot of monkey business going on.
I know. I mean, I was literally here. You met the news director for the station, Joe Salzone, before, and he was doing an election night coverage, and he knows the mood I was in that night, because I had this feeling, it was like, oh no, it's going to go wrong again. It's like, this time they're really going to elect him.
It doesn't make sense that people would lie during the exit polls, and the exit polls were so different from what the actual results were. And that's very curious. That doesn't make sense logically or mathematically.
No more politics.
Okay, sorry.
More fun stuff.
I know. So, Dave.
No. This is good. I was doing a lot more politics, believe me, last September, October, November. This one, you know, tuning the guitar, by the way, with Christine Lavin.
Hey, you know it would be nice to play? A romantic song from the
Ooh.
Record?
Oh, yes.
I slowed down the Beatles song, All My Lovin'. Well, actually, there's an interesting story about this recording. Can I tell you the story?
Yeah.
Okay. I live in Manhattan, about a mile and a half from the Ed Sullivan Theater. And on February 9th, 1964, I was one of the, let's say I was 12 years old. How old were you then? Were you alive then?
I was a month.
You were a month old?
I was post-sperm, post-embryo. I was born January 64, so, yeah.
Oh, okay, so you were a month old.
So I didn't really notice the Beatles much at all.
Well,
I had their hair, though. It was cool. Yeah.
So I was one of those people who watched them, and it changed everything musically for people of our age. So, but I always thought, and the first song they ever sang was All My Lovin', and I always thought it should be a ballad, because it's very, very romantic. But there, you know, there's Close Your Eyes and All Kitties. So what I did was, on February 7th, 2004, which was the 40th anniversary of the Beatles landing at JFK, I went into a recording studio just a few blocks from the Ed Sullivan Theater, and I recorded the basic tracks for this new version of All My Lovin'. On February 9th, the anniversary of the actual airing of the show, we mixed the song. I made 40 copies, and I sold them for the shows around Valentine's Day. This is interesting. One of the people who bought one of those original versions of my version of All My Lovin' is the caregiver for Linda McCartney's 98-year-old aunt. And the reason why she bought it, I had these 40 copies made that said, to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. She bought it for $5 so she could show it Linda McCartney's 98-year-old aunt that people do remember Paul McCartney and the Beatles are still popular because she can't believe it. Oh, he's not that popular. Little Paul. And she goes, yeah. You know,
Oh, wow.
But then as I, you know, this record was, we didn't know we were making a record. Every month I would go into the studio with this rock musician named Ryan Bowers. He's in a band called the WMDs, which either stands for the Weapons of Mass Destruction or the Women Doctors, depending on who you talk to. And we were just fooling around, getting new songs down on tape and doing this. So we actually worked on this arrangement for over a year and a half. We kept adding things. We added the strings. We had the cellos. And then when we thought the song was done, I said, you know what it still needs? It needs some kind of an introduction that you can't just go right into the song. But we want an introduction that doesn't quite give it away. So then we brought Robin Bateau back in, who played violin on it, to play a little opening thing. It was kind of dreamy. So if you're sitting there with your sweetheart, now's the time to make your moves.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We're having a terrific time tonight with guest Christine Lavin. So terrific that we're going to keep it going. She will be back next week, Thanksgiving night, with more songs, more stories, more of what makes her such a delightful performer and person. Please check out her website, ChristineLavin.com. Christine Lavin.
Going backward. Yeah. What was the first song you ever wrote? It doesn't have to be a great one.
It's cool. It's called The World is Coming to an End.
There you go.
And I remember one verse because I grew up this military school and they would have these dances and they would bring girls in from girls' schools and it was always a big deal. And so one of the verses of the song went, you've got a big date for the dance, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum. But now you've got a hole in your pants, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. The world is coming to an end.
Cute. Okay. And you were?
I was 13.
Cool. That is pretty good.
Yeah. So I, even back then, I showed signs of having a twisted sense of humor.
After the Baker years and after when you really made the decision to say, I'm going to do this full time. Mm-hmm. And did you have the record label at that point? Were you on Rounder, first of all, the second?
Boy, it's so many years ago. Actually, I produced the Future Fossils record by myself. I recorded it in Brooklyn in Mark Dan's fourth floor attic recording studio. And I sent it to Rounder and they rejected it. And but then I sent it to different radio stations. I sent it to all the radio stations that I knew of that played folk music. And what happened is people walked into record stores in the Boston area and said, do you carry that record by Christine Lavin and Future Fossils? And the record stores didn't know anything about it. But they kept getting so many requests that when the Rounder rep came around, they asked him. And then the Rounder rep at the weekly meeting brought it up. Everybody's asking for this record by Christine Lavin. And the people who rejected it were like, oh!
Was that the best day of your life?
Well, it was quite interesting. And it's a nice story for people to hear because it's a very hard business. And now it's harder than ever. But it shows that they said no, and then they ended up selling 800 of the first 2,000 vinyl records, and then I was suddenly out of stock, and I said, how do I repress? I don't know what I was doing. And they said, you know what? We'll put it on our label, and then so they offered me a contract. And
good.
But it was, so for all you kids out there who are thinking of doing this, remember that was no, yes.
Well, I do want to follow up then when you say, well, yes, the music business is hard, but harder than ever. Why?
A lot of it, because I travel a great deal. Just recently I was in Florida. I got out just before the hurricanes, which is good. I think the economics of the country right now, everybody's very tight with money. I know I am. I'm making less money than I made last year, so I'm being a little more careful about it. People, to go out to see a show is a luxury. You don't need to do this. I mean, it's good for your soul. We want you to come out, but if it's a choice.
Well, unless it's Michael Bolton, but yeah, okay.
If it's a choice between feeding your family and going out to a show, you have to feed your family first. So, but it's also very exciting in ways because I've been meeting so many people who are musicians or just music fans who are creating their own scenes. I did a house concert in Colorado Springs. These people had 150 people in their living room. And they hire a guy with a sound system. And it was a really nice paycheck. I sold a lot of CDs. And I met just the greatest people in, of all places, Colorado Springs, which is very right-wing. The Air Force Academy is out there at the, you know, bastion of conservative Christians. But there's this great folk community based around, I don't even remember, well, her name is Whitney and his name is Dave. I don't remember their last names. And I was just out in Birmingham, Alabama. I performed at a place called Work Play, beautiful performance space, and it's run by this woman named Mae Robertson. Have you heard of her?
Sorry, no.
Spell it M-A-E-R-O-B-E-R-T-S-O-N. Go to her website. She is a fabulous singer-songwriter in her own right, and she's created this scene in, of all places, Birmingham, Alabama. Again, a red state. And I was there on a, I'm trying to think what day of the week, it was like a Monday night. It was Monday night. And I had, you know, 200 people on a Monday night in Birmingham, Alabama, because this singer-songwriter is stopped waiting for somebody to come along and create a space for it. She's created it herself. So she MCs. And I asked her to do a song in the show, and she wouldn't. She goes, oh, they're so sick of me. I said, Mae, no, they're not. They love you. But she didn't want, I had never played there before. She didn't want me to give up any time in the show at all. But and I feel like there's so many other people who are, it's this very grassroots kind of way, who are creating scenes for music. We have to just work a whole lot harder to connect with these people.
Do you have any feelings about now the switch in formats that, you know, I grew up in the record era and then into 8-track tape and cassettes, and then, okay, I made the switch to CDs, no problem, and now within 5 years it's probably going to be all digital and iPods and all that. Are you part of the iPod generation?
No, I don't have an iPod yet myself. But
or satellite radio or any of these new kind of...
Well, see, I've been doing shows for XM. I'm unpaid. But I'm doing a show called Slip Discs, and they're discs that people slip to me. Like, I'm going to do a whole show just on Mae Robertson from her. She gave me four of her albums. She gave me a record by a guy named Carl Carruthers, hilarious songwriter. And I'm going to play him. So, but the thing is, you know, XM loves my shows, but they said, we are never, ever going to pay people to program the folk channel. But we love your shows, and we hope you'll still do them. They didn't say never. They said never, ever. So to me, it's like my hobby is to collect these CDs as I travel. It takes a lot of time, but the great thing is, the great thing with XM, and I'm so happy to, you know what, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Maybe you shouldn't even, well.
No, I should, I don't want to break in, but I had an interview with Oscar Brand earlier in the day, and he's been doing his show, the Folk Song Festival, on WNYC, National Public Radio, public radio station, for 60 years in December. He is free. He's never been paid a dime, and he's had to shell out money to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I would figure at some point.
Well, with XM, the CDs that I play, they put them into their library, so I lose all my CDs, and I don't get paid. But to me, it is so worth it, because they do pay songwriting royalties. And yesterday I got a call from Eric Franz, and he got two checks in the mail, because when I played his stuff, I guess I must have mentioned, if you want to buy the record, send him a check. And they're doing it. And all these people write to XM, and they say, who is that, who is that? They send me the email. I write back and say, this is who it is. Here's their email. You can buy their CDs directly. So there's a guy named William Putman up in Alaska who is selling. He's never played in the lower 48, and yet he's selling CDs to people who hear him on XM. And now Eric Franzen, and then today, Seat of the Pants Band, which is David Lutkin and Helen Russell. These are theater people who did Woody Guthrie's American Song.
Right.
I played their brand new record called The Seat of the Pants Band, and now all these people are writing in trying to get there, so I'm hooking them up. So it's really giving us a way. I think ultimately, all of this satellite technology, and with these little teeny-weeny little ninny-nano iPods, they all need content. And that for people who are doing good music, and I'm so particular in the songs that I choose to play over these shows, that the good songwriters, if they can just hold on.
Well, easier said than done, but yeah.
Will eventually be able to find a much larger audience. And I think a lot of the mediocre stuff that is coming from the... Like, I'm so completely mystified at the success of Ashley Simpson. I mean, she humiliated herself on Saturday Night Live, being caught lip-syncing, and I watch her, and I mean, I'm baffled. She's not a good singer. I don't think she really writes. She's not even pretty. She's got a pretty sister, and I'm thinking, why is she a star? What the hell is this all about?
Well,
and
I think you haven't noticed the bribery scandal that's been going on that well.
Well, see, I know. Like, yeah. I read the book Hitman, and I know that you can pay off people to play anything, but you can't force people to buy it. People must be buying her records.
Well, if you play something 20 times and it's catchy in any way, it'll catch on. If something doesn't get played, it won't catch on. So that's...
I know, but still, I think... Because one of the songs that they talked about in Hitman was the song Jesse by Carly Simon. Because I remember that song was played...
It's a Joan Baez song, isn't it?
No, that's a Janis Ian. It's
Sam. Oh, sorry. Okay.
No, I love Carly Simon, but that song, I thought, that song sucks. Man, but it's played so much. And then I read in Hitman, that was one of the songs that they had... were totally paid off to play, and that's where they said, you can pay off anybody to play anything, but you can't force people to buy it. So that song, no matter how much it was promoted, it didn't become a hit. It didn't make a lot of money because, ultimately wasn't a good song.
Well, first of all, I do want to thank Christine Lavin for giving me $100 before, and that was in order to play... What did you want to play? Make it worth it, because, I normally charge $250, so...
Can I do a new song for you?
By all means, please.
Okay, this sort of relates to some of the things that we've been talking about, too. I've been writing songs for 41 years. I try to rhyme everything I see and I hear. But as I grow older, I don't know why, I'm writing songs that go up way too high. Why do I write songs I cannot sing well? Is this elevator? You might hear and howl. Why do I choose to humiliate myself? Writing songs I cannot sing well.
Poor Dave, you look like you're in pain. Should I stop?
No, please continue.
I've been playing guitar since 1964. Yes, the year that the Beatles appeared on our shore. I was content strumming C, F, and G. What the hell has come over me? Why do I write guitar charts I cannot play well? Is this elevator music you might hear in hell? Why do I choose to humiliate myself? Writing guitar charts I cannot play well. I took 2 years of Spanish in high school. I think gringos who speak Espanol are muy cool. I dreamed of writing a song that contains Spanish lyrics. Maybe someday Antonio Banderas will hear it. Porque escribe yo canto no bueno esta música elevatore del diablo. Porque yo quiero humilia chacha yo soy. ¿Qué hora es? Es tiempo yo canto muy mal. Oh, it used to be easy to do what we did. But things are much harder than when we were kids. We drive ourselves crazy as we near the edge. Watch helplessly as some of us step off the ledge. Oh, why are we never satisfied with what we are? We push and we shove As we reach for the stars, we challenge each other to raise up that bar. Never satisfied with what we are. Oh, why do we write songs we don't understand? Who guides the pen that we hold in our hand? Like penguins marching across frozen land, we write songs we don't understand. Everybody now, la 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 la, in Spanish, la 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 la, in Swedish, ya 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 ya, in Japanese, ra 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 ra.
I understood that. Why don't we, is that the Hammond song? Why don't we, I write songs I can't
understand. Yeah, why do we write songs we can't understand? And I had to throw in that little bit about the penguins marching. Did you see that movie?
I didn't see the movie.
Like, why on earth is that this big movie?
It's oh.
Like, I mean, it's sweet. It's
you
like
see it on DVD, did you?
No, I went to the Real
big
Movie
screen.
Theater.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's sort of indicative of the crazy times we're living in, that people love this movie. And it's just, it's about penguins hooking up and having little baby penguins and looking out for them. It's very, very sweet, but it's
yeah.
It's sort of puzzling to me. You know, why that film at this troubled time in the world? Why is that?
Exactly that film at this troubled time in the world. I mean, you can go in the movies and for an hour you can watch penguins. And penguins die in it, I think, so
I
it's not happy.
Oh, my Lord, the little baby penguins. And then the mother, you know, marches 75 miles, whatever it is, and then goes swimming. And then a big seal comes along and eats
oh, no.
Her. And the father is back there, you know, holding the little egg between his feet. And then the mom gets eaten. She never comes back and the egg dies. And the father, but of course, you know, the next mating season, he finds somebody else. You know
right.
How the penguins are.
That's right. Although he did hold a vigil, and, you know, there was benefit and songs for like, the homeless penguins and stuff. It was kind of neat after the 2000th penguin died. But, you know, tell me about Four Bitchin' Babes. How did that come along?
That was, I'm trying to think how that happened. I had this idea. In fact, it came to me in a dream in Cleveland, Ohio. I know this sounds weird, but that's how.
Nobody dreams in Cleveland, Ohio.
It was in June. It was like June 8, 1989, and I woke up and I said, I should put together an album of all winter songs that has nothing to do with Christmas. And I started working on it, and then we did a tour. It was John Gorka, David Wilcox, Patty Larkin, and me. And then the next summer, somebody said, you know, if you put, maybe it was Alan Pepper, who owns the Bottom Line.
Or what was the Bottom Line,
well,
yeah.
He's negotiating with the New Space, though.
Oh, hello.
The Upper West Side of Manhattan, that's all I know. He won't say exactly where it is, but it's the Upper West Side, which is my neighborhood. I'm hoping it's near me. But he said if you put four of the females who are together on the Anna Winter's Night record, that could be a summer tour. And so we started in Chicago, and we ended in Seattle. In Seattle, we sat down. It was Megan McDonough, Sally Fingerette, Patty Larkin, and me, and we figured out how much money we had spent and how much money we had made. We were 3,000 miles from home, and we had lost money. Holy crap!
You're supposed to make money on the road. You lose money on the album.
We lost money. We're 3,000 miles from home.
Oh, man.
So we had one more show, but it was in Washington, D.C., so we thought, you know what, maybe if we tape that show, because now we've done a bunch of shows, maybe we could sell that. Maybe we could, you know, go into the black. And I was most concerned about this because they, Sally and Megan, were married and Sally had a kid, and they were not in a position to lose money. Me as a single person, if I screw up and I don't make money, I'm not hurting a family. I'm
right.
Just, you know, hurting myself. So we taped the show at the Birchmere, and on the cassette of that show, there was a misprint. It says, The Four Bitchin' Babes Live at the Birchmere.
I think that's Freudian. Somebody did that intentionally.
So that record came out, and it was purely our hope to make our money back. And somehow people started playing it, and they said, well, you're going to go on tour again? We're like, well, okay. But Patty, at this point, she had done enough girl groups. She didn't want to do it. But the great thing is that the Babes continues to this day.
Yeah, they're playing in, like, Long Island at some point in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, they just played in Port Washington.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
And it's Deirdre Flint. It's Sally Fingerette. She's the only original from the group. Debbie Smith, fabulous, plays Balron guitar. And... oh, my gosh, it's so embarrassing. She's from Nashville. Nancy Moran.
Cool.
Nancy Moran. So,
but do you have privileges, like you get to join the Babes whenever you want to because you were a founder or...
Well, I was supposed to do a reunion last year, and then I got sick. That was really... I was heartsick over that.
Oh.
But we're all good friends. There was never any big cat fight or anything like that. Hi, this is Christine Lavin. And guess what? You're listening to Dave's Gone By. But I have to ask you, what were you thinking?
By the way, I have to say, you mentioned that you're a single person, but I noticed you got a rock on your on your finger there.
Oh, my boyfriend gave me that. And when he gave it to me, I said, you know, this looks like an engagement ring. He goes, it does.
He didn't even know. He didn't realize that.
No, he's a knucklehead, so.
But most men are, yeah.
He's my knucklehead.
How did you guys meet?
I love him. Believe it or not, I was a wandering minstrel in a Mexican restaurant. And in 1976, and
oh my God, this goes back. You
I know.
Oh.
This is like, yeah, this I want to do an album called or a show called Perpetually Engaged.
So you've had the same boyfriend for you know.
Yeah, there were a couple times we had broke up in between. You know, John Gork and I went out for a while. Did you know we were engaged?
No.
I didn't even bring it up because it was like we were insane. But but he was a customer and I was a wandering minstrel. In a Mexican restaurant. And it's so funny because you heard my Spanish.
Yeah.
Por qué? Escribe. Do you speak any Spanish?
Un poquito from La Escuela Secundaria. That's it. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, that's about what
those are the four words I know, except for the ones I can't say on the radio.
Well, I could say, tu es caballero guapo. When I was in Tampa, I crowned this guy, because I crown the best-looking man in every show that I do. And I said to him, what is your name? And he said, Nelson Vargas. And I was like, oh, my God. So I got to say to him, Nelson Vargas, tu es caballero guapo. That means you are such a fine gentleman.
And he and that
oh,
worked.
He loved it. He
yeah.
loved it, yeah. But then when I did the song, I've been using this song as my encore. I mean, assuming, hoping I get one, you know. Why do we write songs? And then when I came to the part about 2 years of Spanish in high school, I dreamed of writing a song that contains Spanish lyrics. Maybe someday Nelson Vargas will hear it. He was so proud. And it's so much fun to sing that song because when I hold out that note so long, so loud, so wrong, people are like, well, like our friend Joe sitting over here was covering his ears.
Well, Joe doesn't like anything, so that's just except the occasional McDonald's hamburger. But,
do you have
a
girlfriend, Joe? Well, we'll see what we can do about that. There's lots of girls looking for guys who've got problems.
Oh, you talk about problem. He was a right-wing conservative Republican when
no!
I first met him.
No!
Swear to God.
That's okay. You know, my grandfather was a Republican.
I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, honestly, God, true. And then, like, a year after I knew him, he's like, I'm not a Republican anymore. I don't like those people. And I was like, yes, thank you, Joe.
I don't like anyone.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, gosh. More questions. Do you have a little more time with us before you got to hit the
thing?
Good.
I don't know if I could do, well, I mean, I could do something else again live, except it's a song that should I try to do it?
You can try. If it if it comes out really terrible, I'll do it on the black market and blackmail you.
Okay. That's a nice thought. You know, interestingly, Dave Van Ronk said that it's very hard to write a good political song and it's very easy to write a bad one. So it's very interesting because our politics, our political situation is so volatile and so changing. And with having 24-hour news, it's really hard to write about it. But Dave, there is a segment of our society who I really feel has been trod upon just a little too much. And I've written a song because I'm hoping this will help them. So here we are. It's 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Snow has fallen down. People are huddled in doorways all over town. Stamping their feet to keep warm, blowing on their hands. It's sad to see such misery in such a wealthy land. The land, such a wealthy land. Some speak English, some speak...
See, I'm writing songs I can't sing or play!
This is a new one. This is on the new album, too. This is on the song.
No, no, no. This is on the Dr. Demento record.
Little Tough Love there from Christine Levin, letting out her inner bitch on Dave's Gone By.
You know what? The first time I ever sang that song, I'll never forget it. And it was much slower. And it was such a work in progress. I even had the lyrics in front of me. It was at the Birchmere in Washington, D.C. It's a big festival. Everybody's doing two songs. And me, what kind of an idiot in front of 500 people does a song they don't know with the lyrics in front of them? And as soon as the came to the chorus, and I felt this tension in the audience, and I was like, oh my God, this is not working. What was I thinking? And so the song got like golf applause, and this woman came up to me in the lobby afterwards. She goes, you know, Missy, you should think twice before you sing a song like that here in Virginia. In Virginia, tobacco is a state vegetable. So I thought,
that's, by the way, that is another name of a Christine Levin song, as is Inner Bitch. You gotta understand, folks, this woman has 17 or so albums out, every one a treasure. I don't know if I've heard
so
every
nice
17,
you.
But they probably are. I know there's gems throughout.
Yeah, some of them get sold for a lot of money on eBay, especially.
Oh, good. Because I brought a bunch for you to sign. You know, today also goes right on the auction block. Right? Even have a Craigslist. I don't know which one to do. But let me ask you, talking about live performances and all that, mm-hmm. What was like the very, very best, most special live stage performance that you ever gave, and what was the worst, most disastrous experience? I love asking that question.
Oh, have I got it. The worst. Wait, first I should...
The nice one. First the nice one.
Actually, I got to say my most thrilling time to be on stage, I mean, it's kind of sad now I think about it, but I think it was November 25th, 2001. And it was at the Bottom Line in New York City. We did a benefit concert to raise money for Dave Van Ronk, who was in the hospital. And I worked with Alan Pepper on the show. It was Peter, Paul, and Mary, Arlo Guthrie, and Tom Paxton. And Arlo Guthrie played at Carnegie Hall the night before with big orchestra, because it was the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. Arlo does a big thing at Carnegie Hall every Thanksgiving. And Peter, Paul, and Mary had never played the Bottom Line.
Wow.
And when we, you know, I called up because I knew the performance. I mean, I'm just thrilled that I actually can call from Peter, Paul, Mary.
Sure.
And Arlo.
Apparently, Mary's actually having some serious illness right now.
But you know what though? She's they're playing December 9th at Carnegie Hall. I bought my tickets, even though I have a gig on December 9th.
Oh, I thought she had taken the turn for the worst. No, she's
in April. She had a bone marrow transplant. You know what? That's why I brought this newspaper. I forgot there was a reason I want to show it to you, because there's a really nice. Did I do something?
No, we just don't want you to hurt your guitar.
Oh, it's all right. It's my
it's the crappy guitar you use for Long Island.
No, the thing is, it's my other guitar. Where is this thing?
Christine Levin is flipping through the Daily News as we speak.
David Hinckley wrote a really nice thing. She had a bone marrow transplant in April, and it worked.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I set up an email that doesn't exist anymore. It's called getwellmary@aol.com and asked people to send jokes for Mary Travis because she loves jokes. And she is so much better. And she's lost a lot of weight. She's been working with a personal trainer 3 times a month. So I'm going to be sitting in row Q on the side at Carnegie Hall the night, because I had this other thing I'm supposed to do, some John Lennon tribute, and I said they have to put me on early so I can run over to Carnegie Hall. Here it is!
Yay!
It's a self-fret folk star Travers on the Mend.
On the Mend. For many years, Peter, Paul, and Mary have played a Christmas and Hanukkah concert at Carnegie Hall this year, December 9th, and that's actually a day before...
It's Friday.
Right. Friday. The show will also have a strong touch of Thanksgiving. And will be 7 months and 2 weeks since Mary Travers had a bone marrow transplant by which she is fighting off acute myelogenous myelogenous. I'll get that sometime. Leukemia. She's 69 years old.
Well, she probably is pissed off that they wrote her age. Women don't like that.
Well, maybe she's 71 and she tells them. Yeah. She's been 69 for the past 5 years, that kind of thing. Well, so, thank you for sharing.
And it's also going to be with the 160 Voice New York Chorale and with a full orchestra. And so it's a Christmas Hanukkah.
I remember seeing one of their holiday shows a few years ago. It was
people
lovely.
Should, you know, yeah. And you actually call Carnegie Hall. You don't call Ticketron or one of those places to get tickets. And there might be some left. They've been selling really fast.
Well, sure.
So
well,
if you're hearing this now, you want to go to the show, stop what you're doing and call Carnegie Hall and get your tickets.
Right. Well, after you've listened to the end of my show, and go for the
phone. So the show that you were talking about.
We
were putting that show together, and Alan Pepper wanted to charge $40 for tickets. And I said, you know what? People love Dave, and this is Arlo Guthrie and Tom Pax and Peter Paul and Mary. They've never done a show this combination. I think it should be $50. And Alan said, I really do. And they both shows sold out in advance. And it raised something like $34,000 for Dave in one day. And it was, people asked me, they said, are you going to do a song in the show? And I said, no, that's not where people are. I was in the finale. We had a whole bunch of people on stage. But I felt I was emceeing. And for $50, you know, people weren't coming to see me. And I just felt it was.
Well, but they would have loved to hear. Did you tell about learning guitar from him? Or you could have played a song that he taught you or something like that?
Oh, well, yeah, but But that, I just remember being backstage, and we had raffle tickets. Matt Umanoff donated two guitars, and Frank Christian donated guitar lessons, and it was so much fun. And that was, and it's funny because really that's my proudest moment on stage, and I wasn't actually singing. I was just instrumental putting the night together. But that's really my happiest moment. Now, the worst.
And it's funny, when you said 2001, I thought, it's going to be a 9/11 thing, but it turned out to be a Dave Van Ronk thing.
You
know?
You know what, though? Dave, he lived close to Ground Zero, and the air was so bad that they had to keep giving him prednisone so that they could operate on him. And large doses of prednisone over a long period of time compromise your immune system and end up dying from an infection. So in a way, I still think of it as like collateral damage from 9/11 because...
Probably was on some level.
You know, the pipe organ in that church down by Ground Zero had to be replaced. The pipes were destroyed by the air. And that's why when people say that there's no such thing as, you know, some illness that the workers got from Ground Zero, if the pipe organ was destroyed by the air, imagine what it did to human lungs. So, anyway.
Anywho.
But that was, you know.
But enough death and destruction. Okay. Let's hear something funny.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Opening for Joan Rivers in Palm Beach, though I think of it as Bomb Beach.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my God.
But you could play to that audience. You have funny songs.
The stars, the cards were stacked against me. It was billed as An Evening with Joan Rivers.
Okay.
And it was sold out as An Evening with Joan Rivers. And then, turns out her show is 75 minutes long, which is typical for, you know, that kind of performer. And so they wanted a 30-minute opener, and they said, don't worry, we'll put your name in the marquee and we'll put a thing in the program, which they did neither. I got to say, Joan Rivers and her people were so nice to me. But this is what they told me.
How long ago was this, by the way?
7 years, maybe.
Okay.
So what happened is, they said, Joan Rivers is going to introduce you, so when you hear her say your name, immediately walk out. So I'm standing in the wings, and they make this announcement, ladies and gentlemen, please turn off all cell phones and cam, no taking pictures. And then you hear Joan Rivers' voice. She goes, oh, hi, everybody. Well, now we're going to have an opening act. This is the best I can find in my price range. Your name is Christine Lavin. So I heard my name, and they said, as soon as you hear your name, walk out.
No.
So I walk out, and I'm standing there, and she's still talking. It's just her voice. She's backstage.
Yeah,
they can't see her.
Oh, yeah.
And because where I'm standing, I can't understand what it's like. And she's going on and on, and I'm standing there and standing there and standing there. And then she goes, so please welcome Christine Lavin. They meant the second time to walk out.
Walk out.
So I start out there, and people have, and I see them rippling through the program like, who the hell is this? What? And so I started to play, and it was really, it started off as like golf applause. And then I made a really big error. I played Bald Headed Men. And there were a lot of guys there with rugs on their heads. And I actually went out.
Miami.
Spied on the audience. It was Palm Beach. It's even worse than that. And I saw there were a lot of guys there who had toupees and ball gowns. And I thought, oh, they'll like this song. Well, that was like death. And then I could see that the light from was hitting my guitar and was like, people were sort of squinting as the light hits them. So I'm trying to move around in a way that I'm not hitting one person all the time. And I realize, oh, my God, I'm moving like a spaz. I wonder if they think there's something wrong with me. I better explain. So I said to them, I'm sorry. I know I'm moving sort of funny, but I see the light. My guitar is hitting you in the eyes. I'm trying to blind you all equally. I'm trying to blind you all equally. That's not what I meant, but that's what I said.
Well, that's a good line, though.
No, they already hate me. And they're going, no, I'm trying to blind them. And then the cat calls, trying to go, get off the stage!
No.
Oh, yeah. Who are you? We're Joan Rivers. We love Joan Rivers. We hate you. Spare us. Oh, I promised Joan's people that I would do 30 minutes.
The full, yeah.
Because that's what they wanted. And it never occurred to me that maybe I should walk off. So it was just that.
Oh, that's brutal.
But then at the very end, I twirl batons. And I twirl batons that glow in the dark. And all the lights are supposed to go off, but the lights didn't go off. So I'm twirling and twirling these lit batons in full light. And finally, I mean, I was so exasperated, but I was so lucky I was still alive and nobody threw it. I threw the baton up as high as I could possibly throw it, and at the very, very, very top of its trajectory, the lights went off. And the baton came down, and I caught it. And I got this mock applause. Yay! Get up! Yay! Walk off the stage. I go to my dressing room, and I started to cry. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. Because my agent said, oh, this will be so wonderful. Joan's going to love you. She's going to take you all over the world performing with her. So I'm in the dressing room, and I'm crying. And then the producer of the show comes in and goes, oh, Christine, you were wonderful. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, don't let a few rude people ruin it for you. You were wonderful. I said, I was there. They hated me. He goes, would you like to go down and say hello to Joan before she goes? I was like, no. Get me out of here. So I ran back to the hotel. I flew back to New York the next day. And three times the promoter left messages. Christine, Joan Rivers came out on stage and said, wasn't Christine Lavin wonderful? Oh, and there was such a roar of approval. I called them back and said, look, I was there. You're a very nice man.
Very nice of him to say
but
it.
I was there. So that was.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Why I think of it as Bomb Beach.
And the fact that this happened not like when you were first starting your career, that's really like. I mean, people should have known who you were.
Well,
sure
not
that they
bad.
Said.
Not, you know, if you think about it, probably the median age was 80. And all the women look like Nancy Reagan. And all the guys look like that, you know, they're all with their those little rugs on their heads and their little suits. Oh, it was just, but you know what, though? I seem to have gigs like that maybe once every 2 or 3 years where it reminds me how lucky I am to play for audiences who like the music that I do, that it's a cold, cruel world out there when you step out of your comfort zone. It would be very nice if you could, you know, people could just like you've never seen you before. But I think when you're psyched up to hear A Night of Joan Rivers, you know, because your humor is very like,
sure.
And my songs are, they're not, you know, if they're funny, it's not hit you over the head funny, and it's not every 30 seconds or every 10 seconds.
Well, some of your songs, I mean, not to, this is a good thing. Some of your songs are quite funny and quite, you know, going all the way back to, I didn't even mention, my gosh, on not your first book, I think your second album, you have a song called The Amoeba Hop.
That was
the first song of yours I really ever heard.
Really?
And I always love it. It's a sweet, funny song, and it's not just a song anymore.
It's a children's book.
That's put out by...
It's Puddle Jump Press.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the imprint is owned by Betsy Francofini, who's the illustrator. And the song was written in 1980, and this book came out in 2003. And this year, in January of 2005, it received a Best Book Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Because it's absolutely scientifically accurate. There's 4 pages of real science in the back of the book. And for students, it's the yellow pages that just before the music.
Oh, okay, I'm looking for the book as she's talking.
Yeah. That's the
oh, there we go.
Real science. And
it shows you actually how to make a knapsack bomb. This is so cool.
Don't make jokes. No, like that. You are sick. But I like it. I like that.
You have no idea. Okay.
But it took 23 years from the song being written to turning into a kids' book. And over that period of time, every once in a while I would get a letter from a school teacher who would just use the song with her. I got the cutest letter from this one teacher. She had fourth graders, and they took the song Yaniba Hop, and she broke them into four teams, and each team was assigned a different one-celled creature. Oh. They had to make costumes based on that one-celled creature and then do a dance to the Amoeba Hop song based on the movements of those one-celled creatures. And they actually had an Amoeba Hop in their classroom and had a contest and crowned
a winner. Oh, did they take pictures? Did you see any of it?
No, but they've drawn pictures and sent me pictures, some kids who really like that. But now there's an actual real book.
It's a lovely book. It's the beautiful. Illustrations are adorable, and it's the lyrics of the song that accompany the book.
The CD's in the front, so it's a CD single. And if people are interested, they can go to my website, which is ChristineLavin.com, or they can go directly to Betsy, which is PuddleJumpPress.com, and they can get it directly from Betsy. And she's a calligrapher, so she can also, you know, autograph it.
Oh, that's sweet.
Hi, this is Christine Lavin, and you're listening to WGBB AM 1240, Dave's Gone By.
Speaking of your website, ChristineLavin.com, that's also the place where people can buy pretty much everything you've released, for the most part, musically.
Yeah, except my songbook is out of print, but I'm hoping to get that back in print.
And certainly your most recent record, Folk Zinger, on Appleseed Records. You've been on, you left Rounder for a while, you went to Shanaki, I think.
Shanaki, they promised me how they're going to promote me. Oh, it was like the biggest mistake of my life was to leave Rounder. But luckily, you know, we're all staying friends. And now I'm with Appleseed, which is a very nice company. Pete Seeger is with them, Donovan. Donovan is on Apple.
Oh, you bring up Donovan because you mentioned him on your album, right?
I know. Yeah. When I wrote that and covered the song "Tell the Story," I had no idea we're on the same label.
Wow.
So it's
and also Tom Paxton's last album was on Appleseed.
Yeah,
so that's,
they're a very, very nice company, and anything that you know that's connected to Pete Seeger, you know, is on the up and up because he's such a national treasure.
And I do have to kind of wrap this up, but I do want to hear any Pete Seeger stories. And then I have another question to ask you, but
I do have a great Pete Seeger story.
Cool.
A couple of things. I did a show where I got to sit next to him on stage the whole show and with other performers, and he leaned over to me in the middle of the show, and he goes, "Hey, do you need a joke for your show?" What, Pete Seeger asked you if you need a joke for your show, what are you going to do, say no? So I said, "Yeah." He goes, "This is what you do. You look out at the audience and you say, does anybody here believe in reincarnation? If they say yes, you say, nice to see you again."
That's a good one.
That's a Pete Seeger joke. And
that's cute, actually. At least he wasn't trying to unplug your amp. It's like, they can't hear the words. No.
He's so sweet.
No,
but this summer, I was at the Hudson River Revival, which the Clearwater, which is his project. And we were setting up for a humor workshop. It was Modern Man, the trio Modern Man, Zoe Lewis, who's just... Do you know Zoe Lewis?
I'm sorry, no, I don't know.
ZoeLewis.com. ZoeLewis. She's got three albums. Oh, she's just funny, clever, wonderful productions. So I met her there. And they're setting up the sound, and it's taking a little bit of time. And there's about 1,000 people sitting in the grass. And over on the side where the performers were all sitting, watching the... waiting for it to start, Pete Seeger's just sitting there, and we're like 50 feet from the Hudson River. The weather had lifted. It was suddenly this gorgeous day, but the sound wasn't ready, and people were getting a little antsy. But George Wurzbach of Modern Man, he knew just the story to kill time, and he looks out at the audience, and he says, "Can I see by a show of hands how many here have ever seen the television program Law and Order?" Of course, every hand shoots up. And he said, "When I'm sitting here, seeing this beautiful Hudson River, seeing Pete Seeger over here, it reminds me of a recent episode of Law and Order. It started like this. These cops are fishing a dead body out of the Hudson River. And Lenny Briscoe, played by the late, great Jerry Orbach, says to the cops, 'You know, when I was a rookie cop, it was my job to fish the floaters out of the Hudson River. But thanks to Pete Seeger and the Clearwater Pals, it's not such a bad job anymore.'" What a great story! It's true!
Did they actually use that line on the...
Yes.
That's nice!
Yes! It's like, Pete Seeger, you go on. You, when you're in a script of Law and Order, you know you've made it.
That's cool.
But it was so funny because everybody clapped and looked at Pete, and he was kind of thinking, what the hell? Because I'm sure he doesn't watch Law and Order. He probably doesn't watch TV at all. But it was just, that was my favorite moment of the whole day.
That is good. Speaking of favorites, do you have a favorite song or two of other people and also one of yours after all these years?
Gosh, Bob Franke, he has a song called For Real. Do you know Bob?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Because I ran into him at the New Bedford Folk Festival, and he has a new live album called Another Night in Chicago, where he not only sings For Real, but the track before he tells the story of his father in World War II. And it's just he is such a brilliant writer, and every time I hear it, it just slices right through me. I just love that song so much. So when I get home, I'm going to tell him.
Please do. Please. Right. Seriously. Away. Yeah.
And a song, favorite song of mine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no fair picking from the new album. Oh. Come on. That's a little bit too craven. You don't have to play it. You can just say, you can play another one to play us out. But I'm thinking of all the, it can be, or Folk Singer if you want. Is your favorite song of yours on Folk Singer?
No, actually, the song that people ask for the most is The Kind of Love You Never Recover From, but I hardly ever sing it because it's hard for me to sing because
not the one that people ask for the most, because the one that is the closest to you that you feel like, oh, that's the best thing I've done, or that's the one that came most from the heart, or the funniest, or...
Yeah, you know, do you want me to play it?
If you want, yeah, I was just asking for the title, but please.
Well,
yeah. Oh, is this The Moment Slips Away?
Yeah.
I love that song.
She's a famous actress, movies and TV. I recognize her as we climb the stairs of the IRT. We cross the street together. We're moving up Broadway. I'm trying to come up with something clever I can say about how I love her work, what it means to me, how in her most recent film she acted brilliantly. Maybe she'll think I'm stupid. Maybe this will make her day. But she disappeared into the crowd, and the moment slipped away. At the time, I didn't know the name of the actress. I just knew that she played Goldie Hawn's mom in Private Benjamin, and she played the mother of the boy with blonde hair in Breaking Away, that great bicycle movie. And I recorded the song in 1986. And by then, I knew that her name was Barbara Barry. So, it was around 1995, I actually got a note from her. She said, "Dear Miss Lavin, I understand that I am the actress in the first verse of your song, The Moment Slipped Away. I think it's a lovely song. Here's my phone number. Please call me up. Let's have tea." So, sometimes I'm very shy, and I never called her up because I didn't know what I would say. I was sort of embarrassed. So, anyway... Years go by, pages of the calendar flip. And in August of 2001, I was a guest on a little radio station in Connecticut called WXPN. They were doing their membership drive, and I was the guest asking people to send in money. Now, I'm very, very bad about asking for money. I'm always afraid when I'm on the air, no one is going to call. I'm going to look like a big loser. So... I said, if you call up and give the station $100 while I am here, I will bake you a loaf of pita pan au chocolat, and I will FedEx it to you so you can have it for breakfast. 18 people called up. So then I had to make 18 loaves of bread, and I was trying to figure out when I could do, because it takes 10 and a half hours to make pita pan au chocolat. You started the night before. So it just happened that I was able to do all of it over 2 days, September 8th and 9th, and on September 10th, I got to Federal Express by 8:45 with 18 little packages to mail out these pita pan au chocolat loaves of bread to these wonderful supporters of public radio in Connecticut. Now, the thing is, I was on such a baking jag that what did I do after doing those 18 loaves of bread? I went home and I thought, you know what? I'm going to make some more. So I started, you make four loaves at a time. I started to make four loaves of bread the night before on September 10th. Well, on September 11th, 2001, when I woke up and saw what was happening down in Lower Manhattan, I wasn't about to bake that bread, so I put the starter into the refrigerator, and I ended up over at my friend Martha's house. And like probably everybody that day, we were glued to the television, but we were 5 miles from ground zero. We wanted to help. We wanted to give blood. There was nothing we could do. We were just hysterical. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to go home. I'm going to bake some bread. My friends were like, what? You're going to make bread today? I said, I started it last night, and at least it's something I can do. So I went home, and I finished making the bread. That's the second step, takes about 3.5 hours. And I was listening to the news and heard that the firehouse in my neighborhood, Ladder 25, some guys are missing. So when the breads were finished, I wrapped them up, and I brought them over to the firehouse. Because I don't know what it is, but whenever you cook or you bake and there's something wrong with the firehouse guys, you want to help. And so by the time I got over there, there were already candles and flowers. And for the next 2.5 months, when I was home in New York and had time, I had 10.5 hours in a row, I would make pain au pain au chocolat for the local firehouse. This went on till about mid-December. One night I was walking over to the firehouse with my breads, and I saw the firemen see me, and I saw them whispering and pointing, and I thought, uh-oh, something's wrong. I wonder if there was something wrong with the last batch of breads. When I got up to them, they didn't know my name or anything. They just said, lady, you've got to find yourself a new hobby. I said, well, was there something wrong with the breads? And they said, no, but we all just had physicals, and we've all gained 20 pounds, at least 20 pounds. So the doctors have told us, no more sweets. Everybody's baking us cookies and cakes and breads. I said, but they're still warm. And he said, I'm really sorry. Please find a new hobby. So I was so embarrassed. But, like, we were all crazy those first few months after 9/11. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll find another firehouse to bake for. So I went to the grocery store to buy more ingredients to bake more pain au pain au chocolat. So there I am with my shopping cart in Fairway and going down the aisle. And who do I see with a shopping cart? Barbara Barry. So I start following her. We go down one aisle and up another, and she just turns around and she says, what? I said, I'm sorry, Miss Barry. I'm Christine Lavin, the songwriter. I wrote The Mama Slipped Away, and you said I should call you up and have tea. And she said, that was like 7 years ago. I said, I know, but I'm shy. So she was, her demeanor completely changed. She was so sweet. And then she saw the little shopping bag with the four little breads in it that I had. And she said, what's that? And I didn't have time to make up a story. So I said to her, well, I've been sort of baking for the firehouse, you know, since 9/11. They lost 7 guys, and I went over there tonight, and they said they've all been putting on weight, and they can't eat it anymore. So she said, I don't have a weight problem. I'll take them off your hands. Kind words don't move the earth, but if they can improve your self-worth, why do I let these moments pass me by? Instead, I am quick to judge and I'm quick to blame. I'm quick to criticize, quick to maim. It's hard to change, but I'll try. So maybe it's your best friend or the next stranger you see. Maybe it's your neighbor. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's me. Who needs to hear encouragement to make it through the day? Who needs to hear whatever kind words you might have to say? It doesn't matter where you're going or where you have been. Right now is the perfect moment for us to begin to appreciate each other in new and different ways. Please don't let another golden moment slip away. Appreciate each other more and more each day or now. Please don't let another golden moment slip away.
what golden moments we have had with Christine Lavin on Dave's Gone By. And it's funny that that song even brings the whole conversation full circle, because the first story that we were talking about was about your meeting Joni Mitchell and letting that moment slip away. And I thought that, you know...
You've got a good memory. I have no memory of that.
Well, you got older. What happened 70 minutes ago is like gone, but that's a lovely... I'm not touching that story. That's lovely.
Well, thanks, Dave, and thanks for playing this music, because it's really... It really is harder and harder to do this for a living these days, and if we didn't have people like you...
Yeah. I wish I were doing it for a living, but there you go. Christine Lavin, please go to ChristineLavin.com, everybody. Get a copy of Folkzinger or some of her older albums. There, so many are terrific. Bo Woes is one of my favorites, but there's also Future Fossils. Please Don't Make Me Too Happy. Compass. There's a bunch of them. Also, you can get the book Amoeba Hop.
Right. Amoeba Hop. It's made for kids from 7 to 9 years old or younger if they're geniuses. And if you're listening to this station, I'm sure you must be a genius.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you're a genius because you can get it on your antenna, that's all. Anyway, Christine, it's been so terrific and so wonderful. You were invited back anytime to the neighborhood, considering it an open door.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your music.